This is Andy Bombeck, and welcome to another Mojo Music program, where I'll be reading articles from Mojo Magazine, along with plain snippets of music. Please let Sun Sounds Radio know if you enjoyed today's program, or how it could be improved. Okay, as I mentioned last week, I'm going to continue reading articles from the November 2024 issue of Mojo Magazine. I'm going to start off with a book review that I didn't get to last week about the Greenwich Village music scene, and then an article about the band The B-52s, and an interview with the people in Chardet's band, and a classic album review of Rust Never Sleeps by Neil Young. I'm going to start off with the book review about Greenwich Village, and this is titled Streets of Fire. New York City's Boho Enclave has a musical legacy too big for this book, says Grayson Haver Curran. Talking Greenwich Village, the heady rise and slow fall of America's bohemian music capital. Greenwich Village occupies less than a square mile of Manhattan, divided as it is on the west side from New Jersey by the Hudson River. But for more than half a century, that little chunk of now prime New York real estate was one of the most fertile zones in American music, fostering not only the folk renaissance and jazz revolutions for which it is most famous, but also essential strains of disco and queer culture at large. Brown, who has written indispensable biogs of Sonic Youth and Tim and Jeff Buckley, takes that municipal zone rather than any specific scene as his subject for this exhaustively researched book, tracing the Byzantine networks of America's bohemian music capital, a little land with an outsized influence. But its institutional status was neither easy to obtain nor immune to market whims. Brown's most revelatory work here follows the legal and local struggles of the haunts that became village landmarks. Washington Square Park and its iconic arch and fountain, the Village Vanguard and Smalls, the Gaslight and Folklore Center. Though few were getting rich in these spaces, their denizens were, in essence, ethnic neighborhood invaders, uplifting spaces others called home, later prompting a faddish tourist boom. Cops, mayors, health inspectors, they were all on the take, pilfering cash drawers to look the other way if they weren't issuing citations. Brown weaves a tale of perseverance and resistance, of energetic upstarts simply seeking a space to exist. But that's just one thread of Brown's busy book, with folk, jazz, blues, rock, punk, and disco crammed into chapters like Village Clubs Themselves. Bob Dylan, of course, looms large, but Dave Von Ronk, for decades, repeatedly the village's next big thing, always on the verge of a breakthrough until his death in 2002, is Brown's most consistent character. He arrives on page 4 and exists in the final sentence. Brown serves the Titan well, showing how many people he taught and connected and how doggedly he advocated for his home turf, even as he languished. Dominance, however, leaves less oxygen for others. Brown shoehorns the village's jazz profusion into such tight spaces, it is almost risible. Near the end, Susan Vega Sean Colvin, and the Roaches become props for the area's artistic collapse, which Brown laments but never fully unpacks. The village lingers now in imaginations because it was a tiny crucible of intensity and impact. Refusing to draw boundaries of time, genre, or scene, Brown renders a survey that, though rich in detail and pointing to the near infinite ways its niches overlapped and expanded, at times feels more like a web of footnotes than a cohesive history. To move on to the article about the B-52s titled Flip Your Wig: Spaceships, Crustacea, Beehives, New Wave Culture, Vultures, the B-52s spun it all into floor-shaking hits, then survived tragedy to become even bigger. As singer Kate Pearson releases a new solo album, she tells Bill Demain of the band's fierce commitment. Even when we were singing about lobsters and volcanoes, we sang like our lives depended on it. November 1978, New York City, Tribeca. Inside the Mud Club, the B-52s are doing a sound check. They're trying not to be distracted by beat writer William Burroughs, who's at the bar in a private eye trench coat and fedora, eyeballing them and scribbling notes. He's flanked by two companions in matching outerwear. The five-piece band from Athens, Georgia, love Fellini movies, and here they are in what could be a scene from one. They'd been asked to be part of a benefit for Semi-Text, a deconstructivist French magazine, and the night's theme was outer space. That's probably why they picked us, because we had a few outer space songs, says Keith Pearson with a laugh. She's being modest. That summer, the B-52s, with their elemental but ferocious dance grooves, thrift store chic, and jittery, three-headed vocal attack, had become darlings of Manhattan's downtown scene, earning props from crested new waivers Blondie and Talking Heads. Their self-released 45 Rock Lobster flew off the shelves at hip Greenwich Village record shop Bleecker Bob's. And there's a little bit of that song, Rock Lobster, by the B-52s.
We were at a party. The earlobe fell in the day. Someone reached in and grabbed it.
The Mud Club show turned weirder, with naked dancers pushing large objects around the stage. Very French, says Pearson. Patti Smith did a few songs. Then, as Pearson and bandmate Cindy Wilson were getting ready backstage, Wilson screamed, "Oh my God, David Bowie's here!" And in came Bowie with Frank Zappa and William Burroughs, three giants of pop's avant-garde. Paying their respects felt like a benediction. A few songs into the set, some big guy in a lobster suit jumped up with us, started dancing, and went right through the stage, Pearson says. Keith Strickland's drum kit almost slid into the hole after him. We got through it with Keith balanced somehow. That was one of the most unusual gigs we ever did, but it was part of our movement in New York City. In Cape Cod, where the lobsters are plentiful, Pearson is talking to Mojo on the beach house she shares with her wife, designer Monica Coleman. It's a bright August morning, and the 76-year-old's vivid hues match it. Long candy red hair, lime green blouse, and specs that frame cornflower blue eyes. She's promoting her second solo album, Radios and Rainbows, featuring collaborations with contemporary Tunesmith producers including Sia, Blue, and Chris Braid. Cast Pearson's still supple belt in everything from noir melodrama, Evil Love, to chic-style disco Wings, with personal and vulnerable lyrics that touch on dysfunctional relationships, spiritual rebirth, and modern politics. Does she feel a difference between her solo work and the B-52s? There's definitely another personality that comes out on my solo album, she says, in a voice with hints of her New Jersey and Georgia backgrounds. I feel like Clark Kent or Clara Kent with the B-52s because we have three singers. There's a lot of trade-offs. You sing this little part, then someone else comes in. On my own, my voice can open up. And on this album, I went to new heights that I didn't even know I could go. Unimagined Heights is a running theme through Pearson's half-century career. It goes back to a night in Athens in late 1976 when five nerdy friends feel they shared a bull-sized tropical cocktail called a Flaming Volcano with five straws. The Flaming Volcano exploded into a creative conjunction, Pearson says with a laugh. Well oiled, they continued on to the house of a friend who happened to have some musical instruments lying around his basement. We started jamming and wrote a song called Killer Bees. Pearson says that became the template for how we wrote. It was so much fun, they decided to continue, but Pearson says they had no designs on becoming famous. I think Ricky had the most forethought and ambition. He used to say he had a 5-year plan, which was never quite revealed. The B-52s, slang for ladies' bouffant hairdos, not World War II bombers, played their first gig, a house party, on Valentine's Day, 1977. All our friends came and danced so hard that someone had to hold the PA speakers to stop them from falling over. We thought, wow, if our friends are dancing like this, we've got something. Pearson was dancing and singing from the time she could walk. Born in New Jersey in 1948, she remembers her dad, a jazz guitarist who loved Django Reinhardt, teaching her first chords. In high school, she went mad for Dylan and formed a protest folk trio called the Sun Donuts. She earned a journalism degree in college, then, disgusted by the Kent State shooting, left America. She hitched around Europe, working as a barmaid in Wallsend. She met her first husband, a mannequin fisherman. They moved back to America, and with the promise of cheap living, chose Athens. We did a back-to-the-land thing, raised goats, grew vegetables, Pearson said. and I had a $15 a month tenant farmer shack with a tin roof. It was the original love shack. But we needed money, so I took a job doing paste-up for the Athens Banner-Herald. A moment for Athens in the mid-70s, it was a smallish city with farms and a bunch of bars scattered around the main campus of the University of Georgia. Even with a progressive arts program, painters Elaine de Kooning and Philip Guston taught there, Greek life ruled the campus. Playboy regularly rated it as one of America's top party schools. Animal House was going to be filmed there in 1977, but the school's president nixed it, deeming the script dirty. One of the deft tricks the B-52s performed was to fuse Athens' seemingly desperate strands, cleverly finding the art nestled within the party. With delight, Pearson recalls, when we started, we were sometimes jeered at by those party guys. The next year, I heard Planet Claire blasting out of all the fraternities. And here's a little bit of that song, Planet Claire, by the B-52s. High on the Valentine's Day gig, the B-52s started jamming 5 days a week. Whenever they weren't working, that is, Kate had her newspaper job, Ricky and Keith hauled baggage at the bus station, Fred waited tables at a vegetarian restaurant, and Cindy made milkshakes at the Whirlycue Luncheonette. They wrote tons of songs. We'd string parts together, like in a collage, Pearson says. They sometimes use Brian Eno's Oblique Strategies cards to sparkle ideas. And they did it all in a disused funeral home. Our rehearsal studio was concrete, with one little window at the top, and it had troughs on the side where the bloodletting used to happen, Pearson says. It was scary and cold in there, but that's all we could afford. That's where we wrote Dance This Mess Around, Private Idaho, Rock Lobster. 50 years on, you can take those songs at face value. They're fun, kooky, danceable. But they're deeper than that. The highest calling for any band is to develop their own unique language. The B-52s took pop and soul, stripped it down to the studs, and refitted it with decades of high and low culture, surf, spy, soundtracks, spoken word. It was post-modernist bingo. The inspirations were so diverse, Pearson affirms, and the university had a great library of international music we raided. We'd check out AKA Pygmy Music, Nino Rota soundtracks, Perez Prado, Yuma Sumac. We had an eclectic palette and one goal, to be a dance band. Did that ultimately prevent them from being taken seriously? Probably, says Pearson, but even when we were singing about lobsters and volcanoes, we sang like our lives depended on it. This band was always very intense. The music's fashion counterpart was a colorful quiche assembled from secondhand shops. We had no money, Pearson said, and there was a thrift store in Athens called the Potter's House. Just a mine of fabulous 60s clothing. And she and Cindy Wilson had a sense of daring. Our aim was not to look glamorous, so we put on all kinds of ugly wigs and bizarre outfits. Were they rebelling against the casual denim drab of the era? Not deliberately, she says. It was just fun and inspired by Fellini. We thought, let's do this outsized kind of look. As their profile rose in Athens, friends encouraged the B-52s to go to New York City. So they drove up in the Wilson family station wagon, nicknamed Croton, after a Doctor Who character, taking their demo tape to the punk new wave epicenter, CBGB, turned them down, but Max's Kansas City said yes. Our first gig at Max's, there were maybe 14 people there, some leaning against the wall, arms crossed in leather jackets. Pearson says, all of a sudden, our friends from Athens swooped in and started dancing like crazy. Afterwards, the band loaded up Croton, ready to drive home. Their friend, Danny Beard, who financed the Rock Lobster 45, said, did you ask if they want you back? No, Pearson says. So Danny ran up and said, do you want them back? Yes, definitely. That started things for us in New York. The buzz started buzzing. Within the year, they were packing Max's, Hurrah, and CBGB. They were sharing daiquiris with Debbie Harry and Chris Stein at their apartment. They had all these gold records lying around. We were like, whoa! Palling around with talking heads and being courted by major labels. A bidding war ended with them signing with Warner Brothers. Jetting off to Compass Point Studio in the Bahamas, the B-52s were convinced they were going to sound bigger and fuller, working with producer Chris Blackwell. Pearson recalls, there's Chris in a captain's hat. He put his feet up on the console, lit a big spliff, and said, I just want you to sound like your sound. When the band heard the playbacks, they were shocked. We sounded so thin and sparse, she continues, but that captured what was unique about us. It was the best decision production-wise ever. Released in July 1979, their debut was a self-assured calling card. Crouched in a traffic-stopping canary yellow pop art sleeve, the band's logo, designed by Ricky's guitar tech and Cindy's future husband, Keith Bennett, got him an F in his university art class. But after Warner's paid Bennett $200 for the rights, it appeared on every B-52 album. From Saturday Night Live, Dave Grohl said that appearance opened a whole new world for him, to discos, to frat parties. Singles Planet Claire and Rop Lobster were everywhere that summer. Even John Lennon loved Rock Lobster's groove and Yoko-isms, saying it inspired his return to music. The band opened for Talking Heads. That first fame, says Pearson, was a whirlwind. Were they as wild offstage as on? Well, we drank and did our share of whatever came around. But we were still nerds, she says. Once we got mad at a promoter and threw donuts at the wall. Backstage. Then we cleaned it up because we felt guilty. A year later, Wild Planet arrived because they'd been so productive in the funeral parlor. There was no sophomore slump. All the songs were about being in motion of some kind. Party Out of Bounds, Strobe Light, Private Idaho, Give Me Back My Man, Cindy Wilson's finest moment, with Strickland's motoric drumming, Wilson's 4- and 5-string open-tune guitar aggression, and the ever-shifting vocal triad, Schneider's campy but menacing speak-sing, Wilson's pastel softness to prehistoric scream, and Pearson's octave-spanning swoop. It's the band at their mightiest. It felt like a letdown, though, Pearson says. It was well received, but at the same time, oh, they didn't change their sound. That planted a seed of doubt. Manager Gary Kerfurst, who also handled the Ramones and Talking Heads, made things worse by tapping David Byrne to produce their next record. But Byrne's focus was on his soundtrack for Twyla Tharp's art dance movie, The Catherine Wheel. The B-52s felt frustrated. Kerfurst pressured them to release something new. First came Party Mix, extended remixes of 6 already released songs, a concept ahead of its time. 5 months later, Mesopotamia followed, a mini-album whose underdeveloped songs sounded like they were hitched to a conga line behind Talking Heads' I, Zimbra. 1983's synth-led Whammy, with the zippy astrological roll call singles, Song for a Future Generation, was more satisfying. Meanwhile, the group thrived on stage, graduating to headlining status. We never paid much attention to record sales because our expectations were low, Pearson says. Artistically, they were high, but celebrity-wise, low. We just kept to ourselves, made the music we wanted to make. We were very insular. After a 2-year pause, they started sessions for Bouncing Off the Satellites, but all was not well. Schneider called it their white album, with everyone bickering and off on solo tangents. Also complicating matters, it would for many 80s bands, was their Seduction by the Fairlight CMI, a sampling keyboard which rendered perfection at a vibe-killing cost. Cue orchestral stabs. It was like Hal, the computer, had sworn up to spoil the band's party. It was definitely a weird time, Pearson sighs. Fred did his first solo record which was great for him. I thought it would be cool for all of us to do whatever outside things we wanted. But that created a kind of split. We weren't working together like we used to. When they played the finished tracks for their label, the response was, "Go back and write a hit," Pearson says. They'd never interfered in our records, never told us how we should look or what we should write. So we kept trying to write a hit. And this was when we noticed Ricky was ill. They didn't know how ill. Though the first news story about the HIV virus had appeared in the gay newspaper New York Native in 1981, it was only just becoming part of the national conversation. Pearson says Keith called and said, "Ricky's in the hospital, and I think he's going to die." And I was like, "Oh my God, no." It just hit us like a thunderbolt. It was devastating. We thought, this is the end. For 3 years, they grieved. We were lost, and we all sort of went bankrupt, Pearson says. I thought, well, what can I do? I'll get a job. She moved to Woodstock, as did Strickland, who decided the best way to honor his childhood friend would be to respectfully step into his shoes. Keith had always played guitar, but he started writing music, Pearson says, and it was incredible. We'd work on ideas, then play them for the rest of the band. We all thought, should we try it again? It became this very healing experience, conjuring up memories of Athens. It felt like Ricky's presence was with us. Before they entered the studio, they made a pact. We said, this is not for commercial success, Pearson says. We're doing this for ourselves. We don't give a fuck about anything else. It sprang from the same place as our first songs, that place of naivete and unself-consciousness. With production chores shared by Don Was and Nile Rodgers, a psychic advised Pearson, the spirit guides favor Don and Nile. 1989's Cosmic Thing was nostalgic deadbeat club rhapsodies, their Athens beginnings. And thanks to the effervescent Love Shack and Rome, both a comeback and complete makeover. People took us more seriously, Pearson says. It was a relief to get out of the corral of indie to be thought of as mainstream. Some fans probably resented it, like, oh, they're not our little band anymore. But it was very gratifying to have that kind of success. And there's a little bit of that B-52 song, Love Shack. During breaks from Cosmic Thing's two-year tour, Pearson duetted with Iggy Pop on Candy and guested on R.E.M.'s Shiny Happy People. I always thought that they wrote that song about the B-52s, she says, but Michael Stipe denied it, saying, it's really about Chinese revolutionaries, and those propaganda posters of shiny, happy people. Okay, then, Love Shack is really about the plight of tenant farmers in Georgia. Before 1992's Good Stuff, Cindy Wilson announced she was leaving the band. She was exhausted from touring, Pearson explains, and she wanted to start a family. We understood and said, come back whenever you want. Schneider made another solo record, and the band kept touring and touring, just for the fans. Over the next 15 years, the remaining three tried several times to reignite their songwriting flame. But it wasn't happening, Pearson says. The planets have to align. It felt like our creativity was on hold. Wilson returned for 2008's Funplex, and the story since then has been more road work with an occasional solo project. Pearson says it's no secret. Everything has changed in the industry. Nobody buys records. Touring is the bread and butter, the only way bands keep going. In support of Radios and Rainbows, Pearson will play some live solo dates, and she says the B-52s aren't quite ready to retire yet. They have a career-spanning documentary in the works, a week-long Vegas residency in November, and in December, an arena show in Athens. But does Schneider's recent post about no more touring after that mean the homecoming gig is their last hurrah? No, we'll keep doing one-off shows and festivals, Pearson says. With the 50-year anniversary of the Flaming Volcano's creative conjunction just up ahead, she says, there's a reason we've stayed together so long. It's because we get each other, we know each other, and we're still, to this day, love each other, which is a beautiful thing. Okay, now the Mojo Eyewitness, the band Sade. Sade's diamond life begins. Sade Adu was a stylist when she met London Latin Ensemble Pride. Soon after, she was fronting a new, streamlined group playing soul, jazz, and sophisticated pop. After Sade's classic Diamond Life hit in the second half of 1984, West End Clubland and Squats with Frozen Pipes made way for international success. 40 years on from their moment-defining debut release, players and friends recall the moment of fusion. It was all positivity and action stations, they say. Sade took the full brunt of the fame. And here's a little bit of one of Sade's most famous hits, Smooth Operator.
Move.
Sade Adu. I always thought that I wanted to do something creative. I wanted to make something, but I never associated it with fame, really. Robert Elms. Sade has studied fashion design at St. Martin's and was working with Spandau Ballet when, in 1981, my mate Lee Barrett asked her if she could sing. She said, yes, how hard can it be? Lee was managing the group Pride, and he wanted her to sing backing vocals and bring some glamour, because she had the look already. She joined, and at some point, they shrunk down to Sade, Stuart Mathisman, guitar and sax, Paul Denneman, bass, and they brought in Andrew Hale, keyboardist, and they became Sade. Simon Booth. I had seen Pride perform. They had a Latin feel, and Sade was singing lead on a couple of tracks. Her father was Nigerian, her mother English, and she had grown up in Essex and had star quality. She was also incredibly nice and down to earth. I had been working with the producer, Robin Millar, on the first Working Week single, Venus Hermos, We Will Win. Stuart played on it, and I mentioned the group to Robin. Robin Millar. The day after, Lee Barrett called. He had two tracks, Your Love is King and Hang On to Your Love. They were good. Sade's voice, even with just a mic in a rehearsal room, had that tone that you knew if people heard it, it would affect them. But there was no structure, really. Her singing was like riffing. It was almost like hip-hop over a funk groove, a solid bass and drums with keys and sax playing around it. R.E. Sade was a soul girl. The first song I heard her sing in the shower was Minnie Riperton's Lovin' You. But she also knew about Fela Kuti because anyone else, and she knew about jazz. She also knew what she wanted her records to sound like, look like, and how they should be presented. Andrew Hale. We bonded over U.S. soul and jazz music, but coming out of that time period of new romantic and post-punk, there was still this idea of the punk DIY aesthetic. And that was really important because we weren't virtuosos. We were young, curious, and played to our limitations. We didn't try to emulate our heroes. We couldn't have, even if we tried. There's a homemade feel to what we were doing. R.M. I was nuts about classic soul arrangements, the horns, the strings, and the percussion, and the vocals. I had a meeting in the studio with Sade, Stuart, Paul, and Andrew, and I thought I was Quincy Jones. They had a singles deal with RCA and had never been in a recording studio, and I said, here's what we do. Martin Ditcham. The vibe in the studio was very creative, but also very relaxed. They were incredibly tight, all working together, all listening to one another. R.M. There was no money, so we worked on the demo for a week in downtown, and we started working on Smooth Operator and another song, Your Love is King. By the end of it, we had six songs. And here's a little bit of that song by Sade, Your Love is King. Andrew Hale. We were new to the studio environment, but Robin and Mike Pala, the engineer, were very good at guiding us. Basically, we believed in the music we were making, and it was exciting to translate that onto tape in the best way we could. Robert Millar. When we finished, we played the songs to the 20 or so people in the studio. Everyone was beaming, nodding their heads. Then Lee took it to RCA, and remember, this is 1983. You've got Depeche Mode and Duran Duran, and they were like, where are the drum machines and the synths? Why has it got sax on it? Lee then took it around all the other labels, and they all rejected it. R.E. I was working at the Face, and I put Chardet on the April 1984 cover of the magazine. It worked, but it wouldn't have worked if they weren't good. Robert Millar. Robert said, have you got enough songs for a gig? We had six songs to Chardet, and Lee secured a gig at Heaven on February 27, 1984, and Robert got the word out to all his mates and pop journalists, and suddenly it was the hot gig of the week. Gary Crawley. There was a real buzz and cues outside. She had this amazing poise and cool about her, and carried herself like a film star. The band were serious. There was a real mood to it, a sense of drama, and you knew these songs. Your Love is King, Smooth Operator, their cover of Timmy Thomas's Why Can't We Live Together, were the business. She reminded me of George Michael, this new breed of pop star. Robert Millar. She was suddenly being hailed as the new Aretha. The deals came flooding in. I said, don't take the deal with the most money, but the deal that offers you the most support artistically. They went with CBS on that basis. Pete Brown. We did the album. We did 15 tracks and 9 went on the album. It was an organic process, putting the guitar, drums, keys down together, live first, then solos and overdubs. Chardet was learning on the job. Some of the songs had only just been written, and she was rewriting and rewriting, and there was a lot of, let's try this. Chardet, we didn't go in for lots of effects and gimmicks. It's more honest that way, and we can write proper songs, really simple songs. R.M. She had a strategic wisdom. She listened to the tracks and she said, we have built something with a mood here, which then made it easier to whittle down the tracks. We got rid of a dance track called Spirit and a Sam Cooke cover, which she said was too jolly. A&R Muff Winwood knew once Chardet did videos, and the public saw her. She'd be a superstar. Chardet worked really hard on the presentation, met with the promotion and press teams, and spent hours on getting everything just right. We all knew it was going to be a hit. A.H. Straight after recording, we'd go to the WAG, Wardour Street Club. Just being there, it fed into the experience and sound of the record. R.E. Your Love is King was the first single in January 1984. Chardet and I were squatting in a disused fire station for the whole time this had been going on, and it was freezing. We only had 1-2 bar electric fire to keep us warm, and a bath was in the kitchen. The day she went to do Your Love is King on Top of the Pops, the toilet had frozen over. CBS sent a big black limousine to pick her up, and by the time she came home that night, everything had changed. They had made it. A.H., we were super nervous and super excited. Top of the Pops was a big deal. We'd all watched it growing up. We all remembered seeing Bowie doing Starman. P.S., Your Love is King was a hit, number 6, March 1984, and they put out When Am I Going to Make a Living in May. Essay, Sade. I can remember in the Pride days walking from Turnpike Lane Tube. It was pouring, and I was soaking wet. I got my pen out and started to write When Am I Going to Make a Living on a soggy envelope. I got halfway through and the pen stopped working. A.H. Sade took the full brunt of the fame and attention and recognition. Us three guys could still jump on a bus and no one would recognize us. So we were just enjoying the moment. We didn't have to deal with the downside. R.M., Diamond Life, started Sade's journey. It's a one-of-a-kind record. It captured the time it was made in, but it could have been made at any time. It launched her career and is one of the best soul LPs to ever come out of the UK. Okay, now it's time for the classic album review, and this week it's Rust Never Sleeps by Neil Young and Crazy Horse, 1979. By 1979, Neil Young was celebrating surviving the 1970s with his integrity intact. Village Voice magazine even nominated him as Artist of the Decade, confirming him as one of the few stars of his era, along with Dylan and Van Morrison, to make the successful transition. Young was forging ahead with his solo career on two fronts. A film entitled Rust Never Sleeps premiered in July 1979, comprising concert footage shot at the previous year at San Francisco's Cow Palace. But a simultaneously released album of the same title was more interesting. An acoustic side featured Young solo, while an electric side saw him backed by stage band Crazy Horse. The record is bookend by variations on a song, My, My, Hey, Hey, which ruminated on the fleeting nature of stardom. It became legendary after Nirvana's Kurt Cobain quoted it in his suicide note. And here's a little bit of that song by Neil Young, My, My, Hey, Hey. Blue and into the black. Acoustic highlights include Pocahontas, inspired by Sachin Littlefeather's appearance at the Academy Awards to turn down Marlon Brando's Oscar for his role in The Godfather. Young had explored the destruction of the Native American people on Buffalo Springfield's Broken Arrow. Thrasher was a veiled commentary on his relationship with Crosby, Stills, and Nash. The four scorching electric numbers on side two, recorded live, but with audience sound removed, kicked off with Powderfinger, a western tale, and concluded by the second blast of the album's theme song entitled Hey Hey My My, Into the Black. The sound of an artist refusing to burn out or fade away. And here's a little bit of that Neil Young song, Powderfinger, from his album, Rust Never Sleeps. Once again, unfortunately, that's all the time that we have for today. Please join me next week when I continue reading articles from the November 2024 issue of Mojo Magazine. I'm going to start off with an article about David Gilmour, lead guitarist for Pink Floyd, who has a new solo album out. Also, a documentary about Electric Lady Studios, Jimi Hendrix's studio in New York City, and a classic album review of Pink Moon by Nick Drake. Well, until then, this is Andy Bombeck for Mojo Music saying so long and keep rockin'.